Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
How often have you found yourself feeling like everything is just getting a bit much? There's so much on your plate, so much demanding your attention that you've become a bit overwhelmed. It hits a point where it feels like there's just no space left just to live, no room to breathe. And maybe it's a sad indictment on modern life, but this feels like a really common way to feel at the moment. It seems like a very relatable sensation to many, many people. And yet finding ways to combat it, finding respite, well, that seems a bit harder than ever. In fact, if we're looking for a break, being busy, being overwhelmed, it has almost become a badge of success. It's not okay sometimes to say that you're pulling back. This hustle culture, this grind set demands that we keep putting effort in. So how do you begin to make changes? Well, it's what Jodie Wilson is exploring in her latest book. It's on shelves as of just, I think, a day or two ago. Jodie is a renowned author and health journalist. And when it comes to finding a space outside the hubbub, she walks the walk as much as she talks the talk. The new book is called A Brain That Breathes. It comes from personal experience and in-depth research, chats with neuroscientists, psychologists, sustainability experts, and more. Jodie, a very big welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Nick. Lovely to be here.
I want to start at the basics, and let's just get this out so I think we all know where we're coming from. What do you mean by a brain that breathes?
I mean a brain that feels like it's not really stuck and heavy and overwhelmed. And I think that we all know that feeling of not being able to really make another decision, or of feeling that we're really uninspired because new ideas seem too far away. And a feeling like there's so much going on in our heads that we just have to do the next most necessary thing because we can't think much further than that. And I know that experience really well. I've kind of lived with anxiety for most of my life. I'm a mother of four, so I know the mental load very well. But a few years ago, I'd written three books in 3 years, and I really started to wonder what my brain needed in order to keep being productive and creative. And around me, everyone was also constantly talking about the overwhelm of our very normal lives. And that kind of left me with a lot of questions about why we're not coping.
Jodie, I was kind of interested in getting a bit more of your origin story, as it were. I mean, because I think, as I've just been saying, nearly all of us are feeling stressed and pressured. Not many people take the steps that you did. Not many people start going, well, hang on, let's look into this and let's make some changes. Can you take me back sort of that 8-odd years ago and what changes you did make? But what was the real, I guess, aha moment, the kick in the bum that said, I've got to do this?
I think it was just knowing. Well, it was only about 2 years ago, actually. Ah. It was just knowing. Yeah.
So this is after van life. You're not even counting sort of taking that time out.
Yeah. This is actually quite a new thing, because I'd returned. Well, just to fill your listeners in 2018, my partner and I sold 80% of our belongings and packed our four kids into the four-wheel drive, and we hit the road and caravanned for about 2.5 years. And I remember there was one day about 3 weeks into the trip where I realized that I could close so many of the mental tabs that I had open, and it felt really meaningful. And I remember holding myself in that moment thinking, just remember how this feels to close these mental tabs and to let go of so much of the obligation that exists in normal life. And so we eventually settled in a small town in Tasmania, where there definitely is a very slow pace to life and there is a lot of space. But I am a writer, and I'd written 3 books in 3 years, and 2 of them were very big books in terms of their subject matter. So I was writing about perinatal health. There's a lot of new research now about perinatal health, in particular what happens to the mother's brain during pregnancy to prepare her for parenthood. So with all this new science, there's a lot of questions about motherhood, especially in relation to how society treats mothers. And so in writing these books, which were both, you know, over 400 pages, I was doing a lot of research as a health journalist and really kind of put a medical hat on, even though I was not a medical trained person. And there's a lot of responsibility as well when you're writing books for new parents, because new mothers in particular, you know, postpartum is the most psychologically and physiologically vulnerable time in a woman's life. And there is a lot of judgment about new motherhood. And I never, ever, ever wanted to be the writer that was putting judgment on the page. And so I really invested so much of myself in the writing of that book. And I really do believe I was backpedaling from burnout towards the end of it.
Wow.
And so I knew I wanted to keep writing books, but I knew as well that I did not want to feel the weight of the book like I did that one. And I think that's probably a concept that a lot of artists and creative people and business people, you know, high achievers, we know what that feels like, that the expectation that you put on yourself, the resolute stubbornness that is often required to finish a task, you know, a big task. But I really, there was one thing about researching postpartum that really planted a seed in my brain. And that was that modern motherhood is so hard because there's a massive gap between what our babies need from us biologically and the demands of modern life. So babies do need to be on parents, you know, from birth. They seek safety and security and warmth and the rhythm of breath and heart from their parents. And yet if those parents are living in a cost of living crisis, they're having to return to work much earlier than expected. We're living very isolated lives without communities. And so there's that separation of parent and baby, and that really does make motherhood incredibly hard. And that's not even factoring in the social expectations. And I started to think about our brains and whether there actually is a disconnect between our biology and our normal everyday reality. And it didn't take me much research to realize that there actually is, that our brain really was designed for life 10,000 years ago, you know, and our life in 2026 now is vastly different from that reality. And our brain is not coping with a world of abundance and of being online and always accessible. And in late stage capitalism, where, you know, productivity equals success and we're always encouraged to be better and do better. And so all of these expectations that are on our life and all of these, you know, very normal parts of our life that we often don't question, which is that there is always a phone within reaching distance, and that we're having to work harder to afford normal life. All of these things contributing to a mental load that our brain is really not designed for.
Tony, I want to come back to parenting in a little bit later. I think what's amazing about sort of what you've been saying is, to many people, myself included, selling 80% of your possessions and going caravanning, that would feel like it should be the end. It's like, we're done, we're good now, there's no more dramas, we're okay, we've found the space to breathe. The fact you've come back to do more on this shows, I think, how complex it can be. And look, in the latest book, you are kind of knocking it into a two-parter. And the first is asking what, on the surface, sounds like a really easy question. What do you need to live well? But the more I thought about that, the more I realized I could ask 100 people that and get 100 different answers, I think. So if we distill it, what do we need to live well?
It's a really good question, isn't it? Mm. And on the road, my partner and I realized that we were living so well with so little that we were like, we really don't need a lot to live well. And that's coming from the perspective of, you know, being incredibly privileged, because yes, I mean, there's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We need warmth, we need shelter, we need sunlight, we need nourishment, we need connection. But I think it's also a good question to carry with you, and it feeds into that concept of enoughness that I'm sure we'll get to later. And that's kind of flipping the narrative and like, well, what's enough for me right now? But, you know, we've been out of the van now for 4.5, almost 5 years. And people have asked me for most of that time, how have you held on to the lessons that you learnt on the road? And I think what they're really asking is, how have you prevented your life from filling back up again? Because that's what the van life was. It was a stripping away of everything that was superfluous. And yet we have returned to living in a normal home with, you know, the school run and with me with publishing deadlines. And life did feel, for me personally, unsustainably full for a while there. And that's because my brain was full. And I've now learnt that I wasn't doing the necessary work of decluttering my brain. I was just constantly filling it with stuff. And to be honest with you, that's what most of us are doing. We are constantly filling the brain with more and more stuff, and we're not doing the necessary work of decluttering, in part because modern life has eradicated breathing space.
Jodie Wilson is giving us some of her incredibly valuable time. She's the author of A Brain That Breathes, Essential Habits for an Overwhelming World. Questions, comments, your own experiences, 1-300-800-222. Please give me a call. Text in. I've got a few texts coming through on 0467-922-702. Decluttering, trying to find space in our brain. You flag this, but it can come with a huge amount of guilt, this idea that resting is somehow a guilty pleasure. I'm going to lose time that I should be spending far more importantly. To me, that's one of the hardest mindsets to break.
Yeah, totally. And that's because we feel lazy, don't we? Because yeah. Rest is kind of, it means we're being idle. We're not trying. And yet it's actually absolutely essential for productivity and creativity. And the brain even has something called an ultradian rhythm. So it's basically we have 90 minutes of high brain activity and then 20 minutes of downtime. And that downtime is absolutely essential for that 90 minutes of, you know, being able to work really efficiently. But yeah, it's the decluttering. I like to use the analogy of the kitchen bench, and we all know that the kitchen bench is a magnet for clutter. Mm. And the brain is like that. And when I was chatting to a psychologist from America, Vic Basu, he studied with Stephen and Rachel Kaplan, who were the founders of attention restoration theory in the 80s. And he was telling me that the brain is essentially gorging on information, and our phones make that really easy. So we have what's known as a scarcity mindset, which means the brain thinks, I better get this now because it might not be there later. This is very simplified. But that worked really well, you know, 10,000 years ago when food wasn't guaranteed and neither was shelter or warmth. So we thought, I better get this cave now. I better kind of settle into this cave now so we've got that warmth. Now today, Our brain thinks the same thing when we are scrolling on our phones. I better get this now because it might not be there later. And that means we're gorging on information and statistics and facts and videos and music and news articles. We're gorging, gorging, gorging. The brain is filling, filling, filling with all of this stuff. And that's why we feel exhausted. That's why we feel overwhelmed. It's why we feel stuck. It's why we procrastinate. It's why we digitally switch, which means we're switching between apps and tabs and screens. And every time we do that, there is a switch cost effect. And so if you go from your email to your phone, your brain has to close down one neural pathway and open another. And that contributes to cognitive fatigue and to irritability. We all know that scatty feeling. So there's costs involved, and it makes us less efficient. We're less creative. Those bright ideas do not come. And so I started to look into what we actually need to do to declutter the brain. And we have to do it because modern life has eradicated what I call breathing space, small moments of downtime often. And it's even been removed from our vocabulary because I never hear anyone talking about breathing space or spare time or free time or leisure time. And that's so telling that it just does not exist in our vocabulary anymore. And yet what has been replaced in our vocabulary is that we so casually refer to ourselves as burnt out.
Like it's just a random thing that happens to us.
Yeah, like, oh, I'm burnt out, I'm really burnt out. I'm burning out, like I'm exhausted, I'm just feeling so overwhelmed. Like, gosh, it's a lot, isn't it? Like this is the language I'm hearing.
Yeah.
I'm a woman in my 40s. It's the language I'm hearing in my normal life and online. And so I really started to look at what we need to do to declutter the brain. And yes, rest is one of those things. But there's all these mellow states of waiting and wandering and pottering and pondering, of sitting and staring out the window and having a bit of a think. They all look like nothing, but they're actually the antidote to stress because they allow the brain to declutter all the stuff that it's collected and to ultimately create space. So we have mental clarity, we have aha moments, we come up with new ideas, and we ultimately feel mentally lighter.
1-300-800-222 if you want to give a call and join in on this conversation. A few people saying that they've been working, decluttering the house, thinking about getting in the caravan for a couple of weeks and other bits and pieces. Keep texting in on 0467-922-702. Jody, how much of where we find ourselves in the modern world can we blame on technology?
That's a really good question. And I'm seeing so, with all this new year kind of discussions online and everyone's talking about going analog, you know, everyone wants to be a bit more analog this year. So less scrolling and more strolling, you know, more books, less screens. And it's such a beautiful thing, but I fear that it's also just a bit of a phase and we're not actually asking the deeper questions about why we want to go more analog, and how we're going to make sure it persists for longer than just, you know, a few weeks while our intentions are still clear. I think phones have made life so much easier for many of us because we can do so much on them, and I'm not going to deny that at all. But I also know myself how detrimental the phone is as a distraction, how detrimental it is to our focus and attention, and how powerful it is to hold us. So the man that created the infinite scroll, his name is Azar Ruskin.
Oh, yeah.
It's called a when we do scroll, it's called a ludic loop. So we're kind of held in this perpetual cycle of uncertainty and feedback, and there's just enough dopamine for us to keep scrolling. And when I chatted to a habit specialist in my research for A Brain That Breathes, she actually says that we really need to actively create a really supportive environment where we're actively separating ourselves from the phone if we want to create that space in our brain. So yes, I think technology is part of it, but I also think it's just our busy, expensive lives. And we're constantly, I mean, for anyone that's experiencing any sort of shock at the amount that groceries cost every week, and I'm guessing that is most of us, there's this feeling that we need to be working harder or smarter in order to keep making the money to buy the groceries. And then, you know, there might be a mortgage rate, you know, rise in February. So I'm sure a lot of people are like, shit, like, what's this going to mean for my weekly budget? And if you've got that financial pressure, you do have also that pressure to keep striving. You know, striving is, we're constantly kind of chasing and striving. That's the undercurrent of most of our lives. And it's also how we're raising our kids. You know, we're filling their schedules with extracurricular activities, and that starts from a really young age. Now I've got 4 kids, so I've really seen it as a parent. And success is so wrapped up in achievement. And there was a meme that was going around last year that referred to success as a settled nervous system. Oh, no. And I thought that is so poignant, because most of us do not have that settled nervous system. And that was one of the things that I really considered when I was writing about what do we need to live well. And most of us do not have that settled nervous system, in part because of technology. But yeah, it's a really complex, nuanced conversation, isn't it? Because what we need to live well biologically, and many of us are not living that way. We're not giving our brains the space to declutter. We're not leaning into those mellow states, into that rest, in order to settle to the nervous system. We're not breathing deep. We're taking really shallow breaths, and we're rushing past all the good in our life that perhaps makes us feel most content. And I'm saying this to you, Nick, as someone that has to remind myself of this daily. Like, I'm not this really calm, clear-headed person. This is like daily work. And I think it's also slightly spiritual work. You know, any religion, any spiritual practice is all about coming back to right now, this present moment, because that is all we know. And interestingly, so much of our stress these days is actually uncertainty stress. And I think a lot of people will be experiencing that now in a heat wave that we're having. There's a lot of uncertainty that comes with a heat wave, because it reminds us of the climate crisis. It reminds us of bushfires in our not so distant past. And I think there's an uncertainty that comes with really extreme weather, and it reminds us that we really don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. All we know is this moment. And that was something I explored in the book as well, is, well, how do we deal with uncertainty? And there's a very small percentage of people that have a resilience to uncertainty. It doesn't bother them too much. But for most of us, that is something that we really have to consider and learn to navigate and learn to live with. And that's really hard. And as I write in the book, you know, breathing space, making sure there's more breathing space in your life. This is not a book about overhauling your life and changing everything. And I know it's very ironic that I say that because I did sell 80% of what I owned and packed up my family in a caravan. But I feel like I'm at a different stage now, and I really don't think you need to leave what's normal and necessary in your life to reinstate breathing space, but it is the remedy to our overwhelm. And it's not in, you know, as I write in the book, I could have gone on a Vipassana meditation retreat and sat in silence for 10 days. I didn't want to do that because that would have been leaving my life. I wanted to learn how I could instill small moments of downtime often through every day. And as I write in the book, it's just about starting with today and maybe looking as far ahead as tomorrow. We're just focusing on those moments now. And it really has changed a lot of my life and my brain and my nervous system, because I really do lean into those small moments of rest. I walk without headphones now. I walk every morning, first thing, through all the seasons here in Tasmania. And there's lots of little things I do that has really made sure that I am more grounded and settled, and that I do have a brain that can keep coming up with new ideas, which is quite important when you're writing a book.
Oh, somewhat essential, I would have thought. Jodie Wilson is the author of A Brain That Breathes. I literally, earlier this evening, Jodie, got asked what was in for 26 for me and what was out for 2026 for me. And in for me was leaving the headphones at home. Stop thinking that I have to have headphones in just because I've stepped outside. You know, stop treating a walk through some of the beautiful walking paths in my area as a way to consume more media, catch up on a politics podcast. Stop doing that. And I'm actually kind of really looking forward to trying to make that a genuine part of my life. We've got some texts and we've got some calls. 1-300-800-222 to keep going. Greg's in Byron Bay. He's been waiting patiently on the phone. Greg, welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Nick and Jody. Thanks for the stimulating idea, and what a great idea for a book. Thank you, Jody.
Oh, thank you so much.
I have a few ideas, just food for thought about these matters.
Yeah.
I don't have a mobile phone, so I've resisted.
Wow.
And I'm pleased for that. But it isn't easy.
No, it's not.
There's a matter of working out, I think, the cluttering, the decluttering, a lot of it is working out what's important. There's a fellow called Stephen Covey who wrote a book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and there was a follow-up book to that too, when he reckons that we spend a lot of our time in categories, as he describes, four categories of urgent and not urgent, and combinations of them. So we spend most of our time in the not important urgent space, when if we spend more time in the important not urgent space and did the longer medium term tasks, just remembered to focus on some of them sometimes, that was a way of feeling more effective in life. But just personally, I've noticed when I was setting up a book section in a new store that all of the other shelves were connected to each other. So there were no gaps all the way around the walls of the store, except when it came to my books, and I purposely left gaps. Because I think it's good for the mind in physical to arrange around us spaces and gaps. It makes a more relaxing space.
To see physical gaps in the world as well. I mean, I think it's really interesting, Jody, that we're talking sort of decluttering that can have both physical kind of connotations, but also the decluttering, as you speak about, of your mind as well. And I kind of I like the idea that Greg was putting forward, that we have these spaces where we talk about things that are important but not urgent. Take the breathing room. And that doesn't mean just racing through it. It means giving it time it deserves.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the most charming concepts I came across in my research is soft fascination. And it's a tenet of attention restoration theory. So when we're on a screen, our awareness is hardly focused. It's called hard fascination. And it's a bit like sirens in the street. We can't really look away.
Mm.
Whereas when we're in nature, our awareness is just lightly captivated by the clouds and the trees and the leaves and the grass and the water. And when that happens, our brain is actually doing the good work of decluttering and making space. And there's a set time frame as well, which I know people love. And so that's 3 times a week, 20 minutes at a time,
right,
in a green space, just letting your awareness move lightly from one thing to another. And you'll experience that on your walks, Nick, when you're not distracted by the voices that are coming through your headphones. You'll just allow yourself to be immersed in that soft fascination. And it's only really powerful and beneficial if you do not have your phone with you. Because every time we're checking our phone on our walk, the brain kind of enters a bit of a fragmented mode. And it's just not given that space and time to do the good work of decluttering. And I think it, you know, there's been so much talk in the past decade about decluttering our homes and getting rid of
what's not essential. Yeah.
Does it spark joy? And I think, you know, I've written about simplicity a lot online over the past 15 years. And I'm definitely not a minimalist. I'm one of those people that keeps the glass jars because my pantry is full of lots of different things. Like, if it's useful, why get rid of it? But also, yes, we don't really need that now. It's a fine balance, I think. But I think knowing that soft fascination is a concept, it's a scientific concept, it is so charming. Whenever I've told anyone about it, they just are delighted by it. But I think it's really important to remember that the charming is never going to win out against the engineered in 2026. And we have to be so intentional with creating those moments where we can be softly fascinated and we can just let ourselves settle in nature. And as I write in the book, every day we should be doing something that our ancestors would have done 10,000 years ago, because that is how we care for ourselves. And it's not self-care as such. I think it's basic human care. And I think we have drifted so far from our biology that we have to constantly remind ourselves that we're nature.
1-300-800-222. If you've got anything you'd like to share to the conversation we're having with Jodie Wilson, author of A Brain That Breathes, and also an earlier book called Practicing Simplicity. There's a concept that you get into in the book, which someone's texted about, and I want to get to that in a second, but Karen's texted in from Brisbane. She says, I can't call, I've lost my voice, sorry. She says, I'm a 51-year-old woman who has had anxiety since my early 20s, but in the last 12 months, my tolerance levels have changed and I found myself on the verge of breaking down several times. She says, I think part of this has been due to perimenopause, some osteoarthritis pain, and in November I was diagnosed with ADHD. But I still have trouble staying motivated at work to look after the family and, most importantly, to look after me. Where can I start to make a change?
I think she can start to make a change by making sure that there's breathing space in her life. And this is, you know, it's 5 minutes here, it's 10 minutes there, but it's also understanding what breathing space looks like for you. And I think for a lot of people, that can sometimes feel selfish. And I think for women and mothers in particular, it's really difficult to do that prioritizing. Interestingly, and I'm sure your later guest, Shelley Horton, will discuss this in terms of perimenopause, but estrogen is actually the hormone of like it's highest after birth, obviously, and it's the hormone of basically dedicating your time and your life to someone else. It's a very giving kind of hormone. And that as it dwindles in perimenopause, we just have so much less capacity to support those around us. And I think it's therefore biologically normal for us to turn the attention to ourselves and to really let go of all those expectations around us and start to think, I'm actually going to take care of myself now. And that's not easy, but it's incredibly necessary for your mental health and your contentment. And even when it comes to rest, like rest is subjective. All the studies show that. So you have to figure out what rest looks like for you. And it's not necessarily lying down for 5 minutes when you reach that point of not being able to think straight. It might be walking, just strolling down your street, just gently strolling. I talk in the book about honoring the season you're in, because the life season that we're in, whether that's starting university or new parenthood or divorce or perimenopause, that will dictate so much about what is available to you and what is going to support you. And I really don't think we do that enough in our life, because we just try and keep up with the Joneses and we just try and keep going with what's, you know, normal and necessary. And yet it can create so much mental space for us if we accept the fact that, right, I'm in perimenopause now. There is so much going on in my body. I'm going to have to create new rhythms and routines for myself to support that, to make sure that I can stay motivated and that I can stay well. No amount of magic is going to allow you to escape that life season that you're in. And I think it creates supportive boundaries for you when you can go, well, you know, for new parents, no new parent is going to be able to get up at 5:30 in the morning like I do and go for a solo walk on the beach.
No.
That's not going to happen for them. And I remember being a young parent myself going, gosh, it would be so nice to be able to get up and go for a walk. But what I needed in those early mornings was sleep. And so I'm in a different life stage now. My children are older. I can do that. And so I think reflecting on where you are in your life stage it's actually quite comforting and freeing to go, well, this is what I can do right now and this is what I'm going to prioritize.
Karen, thank you so much for texting in and to ask that as well. And please, if you've got time, do listen in about an hour when Shelley will be talking perimenopause as well. She does talk a lot about some of the mental aspects that come through as well. I feel like, Jodie, I should send you both a copy of each other's books. I feel like we should get some sort of conversation happening with the two of you. I think that'd be a lot of fun. Derek has texted in saying, one of the most important phrases that I think I use is that it's good to be bored, which helps with dopamine detox. And you talk a little bit in the book about boredom being, in some ways, not a bad motivator in the right context.
Yeah, it's kind of the space before curiosity.
Yeah.
And also when we're bored, it's our brain saying, I am really looking for something. And if I think back to my childhood and my teen years, you know, in the 90s, there were so many periods of being bored, and children today are not experiencing that, and adults are definitely not experiencing it either. And yet it is so essential for our creativity, because boredom leads to curiosity, which leads to creativity. Can we be creative without being curious? No, definitely not. And, you know, when we're curious, we are receiving that lovely dopamine as well. But there was a study quite a few years ago that had adults sitting in a room with an electric shock machine, and a very high percentage of them shocked themselves instead of sitting in boredom. So it is uncomfortable, like,
wow.
And we don't like to be uncomfortable, but I think we really need to create and then protect those pockets of boredom, because it's good for the brain and it's also great for our creative minds. You know, if you watch a small child get curious about something, you watch their brain light up. You watch their face light up with the joy of it. Curiosity is the one part of writing books that really spurs me on. Just the reading, the researching, the questioning. I love that part of book writing. When I learnt that connection between boredom, curiosity and creativity, it was one of those kind of spine-tingling moments in the process where I thought, yeah, this is really important. And a lot of people don't go further than thinking about the I'm bored bit. You know, it's got negative connotations, doesn't it?
Oh, completely,
Yeah. Well, it's actually really essential.
Boredom is something that's got to be quashed as soon as it arrives. There's just no space for it. And that seems to be the attitude at the moment. There's about 6 minutes left. We do have time. 1-300-800-222-0467-922-702. Jodie Wilson, author of A Brain That Breathes. And Jodie, I know you spoke to so many neuroscientists. Ken's called in from Darwin with an interesting question about the brain, something that comes up quite a lot, I think. Ken, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
What did you want to ask?
I was just curious. I'm 71 years of age now, and I've always been curious about the brain. I try and exercise it the best I can, but I've been reported over the years that we only use about 10 to 15% of its capacity. Now, is this true or not? Studies that have been done before. Now, have I got the wrong studies, or am I being led up the creek? I'd like to use more of it.
Ken, it's always been interesting because I do remember hearing those stats when I was younger as well, and then sometimes you hear that that's sort of a bit of a myth, and then it just seems to get a bit complex on how you actually come together in it. Did any of that come up, Jodie, in any conversations you were having while putting together this book?
No, it didn't, interestingly. And I'm not a neuroscientist, so I don't feel confident answering that question for you, I'm sorry. But interestingly, there is, I suppose what was most fascinating in my research, and especially when I was talking to the neuroscientists, is that there is so much we do not know about the brain.
Oh.
And it is just, it's both enlightening and fascinating that there is so much science and yet still we know the smallest little bit about it, the brain.
So little. And I remember even back in my university days in the 90s, I did psychology, and it tended to be a bit of a things happen in this brain space, but that's not what we're interested in. So just keep talking. It was sort of almost a bit of a dragons be here element to the human body. Text in says, great topic. I realized when my children were younger and I was very involved in their schools and extracurricular activities, that every single day was jam-packed with tasks. It was almost as if an unscheduled gap of time was a guilt trip of non-productivity. I was exhausted physically and mentally. Texter says, I deliberately blocked off a day every week that was free of appointments, still had the usual housework, but nothing that needed outside. I had to protect and enforce boundaries for my mental health, and it worked. She says, a big thank you to you, Jodie.
Oh, that is so good to hear. Look, I'm a big fan of a day without plans. I think we should really pop it in the diary like we do the doctor's appointments and the social catch-ups. I think it is that important. And there is nothing I like more than a day of pottering at home. Fleetwood Mac playing, candles lit, a good coffee in hand, a bit of a, you know, a flick through a book, maybe a mosey around the garden, a bit of weeding. Like, that is joyful for me. And now I've written this book and I've done the research and I know that's actually really good for my brain and my nervous system as well. So in 2026, I am all for us taking a nap when we feel tired instead of pushing through. I'm all for us making a cup of tea and having a bit of a sit and a stare out the window. I remember my kids always saying to me, "What are you thinking about?" And I'm just like, "I actually don't know what I'm thinking about. I'm just having a good old stare." I think we need more of that. We need more days of pottering. We need to be walking without headphones. We need to be softly fascinated by the natural world, because when we're out there, we do remember and we are reminded that we're human. We're not robots, and we're not designed to just keep going and going and going. We need rest. We need to live in tune with the seasons. We need to honour the season that we're in.
Mm.
And we need to really take care of ourselves in meaningful ways in order to have mental clarity and a brain that lights up with bright ideas and to experience contentment. Like, the opposite of depression is not happiness, it's actually vitality. And I think that is something that we can all take into 2026 with us, that if we want to feel vital, we need to give our brains breathing space.
Jodie Wilson, you have been absolutely amazing and I cannot thank you enough for your time tonight. Jodie's latest book is called A Brain That Breathes. I should have pointed out earlier, she puts a lot of practical tips throughout the book, some wonderful ones. Every chapter ends with 5 key takeaways. So if you are looking for something that will help you make some practical changes, the book is wonderful.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.